Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming to this special debate. I'm delighted to welcome you, but also our speakers as well. We're going to not follow this sequence. I'm going to invite, firstly, Kostas Megier to begin the debate. I'm asking each of the speakers to keep to a rigid 15 minutes maximum. And if they go beyond 15 minutes, perhaps you could forgo any stereotypical cultural inhibitions you might have and simply demand that they finish after 15 minutes, please. So please don't be British and shy. Do come forward and say, it's time to finish, Costa Vasili. Thank you. So, we're going to have Kostas Megier to start us off on this theme of can Greece get out of the economic crisis? Kostas Megier is a professor at the University College London, Department of Economics. He's co-director of the ESRC Research Centre, the Institute for Fiscal Studies. He's a fellow of the British Academy, member of the Council of the Royal Economic Society, an executive member of that society. The CV is stunningly good, highly relevant to this evening. Kostas will set us off with a very good way of putting things in context. He will then be followed by Vasilis Monotriatis, a colleague here in the Hellenic Observatory. Vasilis is a senior lecturer in the European Institute and equally has highly relevant publications in economics and economic geography on Greece, Southeast Europe. So I think you will be given two very good overviews of the economic situation. I'll invite Costa to begin.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much for organizing this event and inviting me. Yes, so I have to... does the time count now? Does this count part of my time? thanks. Well, when I was first a student in Greece, I was really upset that that Greece was never in the news. And also, I also know that all prime ministers since then have all been educated abroad. They probably had the same feeling, and they decided to do something about it. And I think they kind of succeeded there. Okay, so I have very little time, and just a quick overview of where we are. We have a budget deficit of 12.7% in 2009. I'm sure you all know that. We're heading for a debt-to-GDP ratio of 124 by the end of this year. There's been a lot of talk about misleading and inaccurate reporting. There's been a massive increase in the spreads for Greek bonds over and above the Bund. So it's somewhere between 300 and 400 over the last few weeks. There's a recession in Greece, no growth, and unemployment, and a lot of youth unemployment. So it's a pretty grim picture. So the increase in the spread is a signal that markets believe the deficit is unsustainable. And that's, in some sense, part of the key problem. And of course, the Greek government has taken that to heart. We have a Greek government that comes in fresh in this. They can't be blamed for the past. And they've introduced some major austerity measures, at least for the context of Greece, including cuts in public sector pay packages, renewed measures to widen the tax base, and attempting to rally support from Eurozone partners in the belief that with such support, the risk premium will actually come down. Now, at this point, you should ask, why does the deficit and why does the debt matter? Because it doesn't have to matter. Japan has 200% of GDP, debt-to-GDP ratio. The problem is that it matters because the interest rate has been pushed up by the markets and because they believe it's unsustainable above the economic growth rate. And if you do a very simple calculation with that, you'll see that that means an exploding debt-to-GDP ratio unless something happens. And that's why it matters. It creates a cycle of unsustainability. And the only way, if you really don't change anything else, the only way you can correct this is with a massive surplus in the primary deficit. And of course, that would mean dire consequences for the Greek economy. So here's the problem. Now, what are the fundamental issues? The first fundamental issue has to do with the competitiveness of Greece. And this is really the money wage divided by productivity in relation to other countries. And what you see here is Greece's basically unit labor cost fluctuating around 100, in other words, basically going nowhere, improving here a little bit, but indeed you would say, but it's much better than Italy and Spain, the other famous members of our club. But the point is not this. The point is that when you start comparing to countries like Germany, which are at the forefront of trade in a globalized economy, then you see where the problem lies and why Greece, why Greece is not perhaps growing and cannot exploit the globalizing, cannot have a good a competitive position in the globalized economy. So now the other kind of manifestation of this is that. The current account balance has been bad and has been worsening. That's, of course, a manifestation of a loss of competitiveness internationally. So that's kind of, if you like, the reason that the economy has been doing. It's not the deep reason. We'll come to that. But that's basically what this reflects: a lack of international competitiveness, and it also reflects the kind of underlying impulse by Greek governments to make the public sector an employer of the last resort. Now let's look at the other, of course, key problem with Greece is the non-compliance with the tax system. And such non-compliance is highly distortionary. So one might say, well, non-compliance perhaps doesn't matter. Great, we don't pay taxes, so the incentives are great. But it's not like that, because effectively, non-compliance subsidizes low-tech employment. It subsidizes the existence of small firms that do not have big sunk costs that are not visible in some sense. So you subsidize away from the kind of high productivity activities that will allow you to compete in the new globalized world. So, but on top of that, of course, it creates a system, an unfair system, where taxpayers are viewing non-taxpayers as not bearing the burden that they should, and of course that creates social unrest. So, the dysfunctional public sector offers, of course, an excuse for not paying tax. You often talk to Greeks and say, "Why should I pay tax? It just goes to this person doing nothing in some kind of office." Now, this is not further symptoms, but it's that's the wrong title. But read from here. The key to emerging from this long-term crisis are, of course, two: revenue, and on the revenue side, you need to restructure public finances to bring the deficit and future liabilities under control, and we need to implement structural reforms that will improve competitiveness and growth. In other words, we need to address both the tax compliance side and improve the revenue side. And on the other hand, we need to address these long-term issues whose symptoms I showed before about relating to growth. So before we go there, unfortunately, we have to deal with the near future. And Basically, we are here on the brink of default. That's, I think, widely accepted. And the Eurozone has no existing mechanism for such support. There's no legal way in which the Eurozone can officially support Greece unless they do bilateral loans between countries, which we're not sure there's the political will to do. The Stability Pact, on the other hand, has been interpreted flexibly in the past, but for kind of more minor infringements rather than the situation that we have now. So basically, my view is that it would not be such a terrible idea to just go to the IMF. This would preserve the credibility of the euro because it's not violating the Maastricht Treaty by creating institutions that were not viewed before. And it will help the government implement even stricter measures than it has done. But of course, we all understand this has its political cost. It's considered humiliating. However, personally, although some people say default doesn't matter, I think default does matter. And I think it's better to go to the IMF and have a good program of rebalancing the public finances and implementing structural reforms than to just allow things to go, allow us to go to default. Of course, this might never happen because our European partners might invent a mechanism, an IMF-type mechanism within the Eurozone, but it'll be interesting to see how they would be able to achieve that. Now, how did we get there? Well, basically, debt levels have accelerated because the governments, since the 1980s, it's not a new problem, have tried to accommodate all structural issues with the Greek economy by making the public sector an employer of last resort. In some sense, it became the employer at some point. They used the money for not basically for infrastructure spending, but for increasing public pensions and other type of handouts. And key structural reforms were perpetually postponed by all governments. So when the firefighting stops, we have to address these issues of structural reforms. So let me just show you, there is a lot of space for reform. I think I have another 5 minutes, right? So first of all, the hourly productivity of Greece, now this doesn't cause a crisis, but it shows this potential for reform. The hourly productivity of Greece, I have the data to 2003, is about 63% of the EU average. In other words, per hour, a Greek worker produces 63% of what a European worker produces. Never mind comparing, of course, to the US. Employment is low. This is male employment, which started creeping up in the 2000s. I'm not sure where it is now, probably down, of course, but it's not even 60%. This is where EU average is. And female employment is very low. So all these are potential resources that with good reforms can be released for growth. Education in Greece is pretty appalling. We come down, to as far as the PISA results are concerned, we are at the bottom, right? So in both maths and reading, these are 15-year-old kids. So, this compared to Portugal and Spain, which are, of course, problem countries. Germany, Britain, you might be surprised, and the US are above the OECD average. Time to takes to... It takes a long time to get the labor to work. It takes 2 to 3 years to get into work after full-time education and take into account of military service for men. So that's a very sclerotic labor market. If a young person finishes full-time education, they have to wait 2 to 3 years on average to get to a job. That's a real problem. So what do I think should happen in the next 5 minutes? Although I'm sure it will. Exactly. So we have to first of all address the tax system. We have to collect taxes. We have to start collecting taxes, and we have to sort out the revenue side. How should we do this? We should increase VAT. Right. This is anathema in Greece. It's considered very right wing and regressive, but it's not because the rich do not pay income tax in Greece, but they do pay VAT when they go to the shops. So. We have to increase VAT. We can, it's 19% now, it can go up to 25%, and there are exemptions and reductions. We should abolish the reductions. Then, we should compensate very low income salary individuals by increasing non-taxable allowances. So give money back to where you can, to people that actually are paying taxes, and these are the salaried employees. You can increase the non-taxable allowance. You should simplify the tax system and reduce the number of bans, and you should not fall the temptation of increasing corporation tax when we're requiring growth and investment from companies. Also, we should improve compliance by high probability audits, particularly in the service sector, and genuine penalties. We should further increase non-taxable allowances by making medical expenses, home improvement, and so on, tax deductible, but fully tax deductible. In other words, increase the tax allowances. And we should return to objective criteria. Now, this is kind of happening in Greece, and the objective criteria, that means if you've got a yacht, you've got so much income, if you've got cars of so much luxury, you've got so much income, they should come back. Pensions. The dependency ratio in Greece will increase dramatically. We're a nice and healthy and happy living population, so we grow old. So we should abolish all the early retirement on public funds. We should equalize retirement age up to about 67. If the later we do it, we might have to go up to 70. We should move to a funded system, but not like necessarily the British system, where you have all the risk is borne by the pension holder if it's a private pension, but with some kind of it's more akin to the Swedish system, where you have a long run return based on historical returns. So you insure the generations, and at the same time you introduce a pension for low income poor individuals, so you have a funded scheme with an insurance component, which is of course very important, but you have to move away from pay as you go. The public sector. You have to reduce seriously the size of the public sector. It should not be the employer of last resort. You should use retirements to reduce the size and restructure. Improve efficiency of the public sector by eliminating corruption. How, for example, we should introduce a system where civil servants, tax people, and so on, do not interact personally with the public. Happens with correspondence on the internet, very much like in Britain, to a large extent. And we should try and see where we can introduce performance pay where appropriate. The labor market. Well, I've been trying to understand the employment protection legislation in Greece, and it's been evolving. And it's not so clear that it's that stringent. It is stringent, but it's not that stringent. I also saw a presentation by Mr. Ioannou here, who was making that point, part of where I got it from. But I think there is a de facto, very stringent labor market in Greece through the unions. There's very, very bad industrial relations, and there's collective bargaining, and unions can stop the economy working. They can call days out on strike, which are relatively successful and very disruptive, because the ones who do stop are very militant. So we should do something about industrial relations. And we should move wage negotiations towards the firm level, where you can have more flexible wage negotiations, so you need less labor market, less adjustments of the labor force. So we should encourage no strike deals. Collective bargaining is a big problem, I believe, in Greece. And while we have legislation that makes the labor market inflexible, we have a de facto industrial relations situation which makes it even more inflexible than you would think it is by just reading the legal stuff. Finally, the education system is low quality, and we need to start reforms from preschool all the way. We need to make schools accountable. They are not in Greece. Children should be able to move from school to school, carrying with them their expenditure, and not from public to private, just from public to public. Okay, so that's what. So you need to get public schools to compete. We need to transfer employment, responsibility of employing teachers down to the school level, so you can translate that accountability to action. We need to reform higher education to improve teaching and research. How should we do this? We should terminate perpetual student status. You shouldn't be able to be 10 years in university. We should stop students having direct influence on governing bodies, because this creates an inability of departments to react to the educational needs. And we should allow universities to compete for funds for students. Finally, governance and red tape. We should reduce bureaucracy. I'm finishing. We should improve transparency in public finances. And we should create an independent body that can audit the public finances, and whose role would be to audit and authorize the public finances, a bit like a bit like accountants. So we should improve the central control of procurement and enforcement. At the current point, ministries can go out and write IOUs and basically procure, say, medicines and so on, without reference to the central government. As a result, you have ministries building up huge deficits without the knowledge of the Ministry of Finance. That cannot continue. That has to stop. And finally, as I said, we should reduce corruption and with the means that I said. So, can Greece get out of it? There have been important turning points in Greek history. We may be coming up to one. We are Greeks are very resourceful and resilient in adversity, but it has to be understood that we need a powerful reform program based, of course, on consensus. That's the key thing that's sometimes missing in Greece, and that can mark a real new turning point. So the question is, does the political courage exist? And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
Okay, you will sense also from the title that my take on the situation is slightly different. I come in a way from two different ends to this debate. One is the policy, looking at policy making and macroeconomic policy in Greece. The other one is looking at the political economy of a monetary union. And that's also the focus of what I'm going to talk about with the opening title of looking at some misunderstanding the situation, and how does this affect Greece. I'm going to argue that there's three basic misunderstandings that have led us to where we are. One has to do with misunderstanding of the crisis, at least at the EU level. The EU has opted for a national version of fiscal stimulus packages, no clear coordination, other than try to avoid moral hazard problems, not real coordination at the Eurozone level, and obviously there's no bailout for any individual member state. There's some misunderstandings in Greece, but for the purposes of keeping with time, I'll skip those, and some of them have been highlighted in the presentation by Kostas. The main point here is that given the differences in the fiscal positions of the different countries, the asymmetric response to the fiscal response to the crisis actually led to asymmetric shocks inside the Union, and that's why some of the weaker current countries in the region, in the Eurozone, suffer more. A way to look at that is obviously a picture we're becoming very familiar with, is the spreads. And what you can see here is that although in the beginning of the crisis, so that pick here, everybody paid the higher interest rate for their bonds because of the higher risk under the crisis. Once we had started with the fiscal stimuli in the different countries, then we have this divergence, and everybody converges towards cheaper, you know, so that everybody invests in German bonds, and everybody else pays a higher price depending on where they are in terms of credibility. Greece obviously is the champion here. If I continued my graph up to today, I would need a higher ceiling to fit Greece in. So that's a point to be remembered. The other thing is misunderstanding the political economy of all this, misunderstanding moral hazard, again, by the European Union. The first big assumption is that a bailout removes all incentives for compliance. So if you bail out Greece, if you purchase Greek debt, all of a sudden the Portuguese are going to say, well, there's no way, no reason for us to comply, to show any fiscal discipline. Let's go wild, the Germans will save us. I think this is a very naive reading of how policymakers develop policies, how countries feel or don't feel responsible, and how they implement reforms, including tax reforms for the fiscal stance. The other thing, assuming that markets believe in default risks. In other words, assuming that the markets increase the spreads for the Greek bonds because they really think Greece is going to default. There's another reading of the story that says, well, you know, you have to make profit somewhere, so you are seeking for higher rents. Who are you going to bet against? Greece. You inflate the rents, you inflate the spreads, and that's where Greece stands at the moment. I'm sure there's different interpretations to this, but this is at least one of them. And the third thing, assuming that fiscal discipline can be pursued irrespective of conditions in the real economy. Assuming that both the economy and the political situation on the ground, the domestic politics, are irrelevant for, you know, when you need to take reforms to improve the fiscal condition, fiscal consolidation can happen irrespective of how high unemployment is, how drastic the decline in GDP growth, how many people are in the streets, and so forth. This led to an insistence on rules, hard fiscal consolidation, and effectively missing completely the plan of having a joint recovery plan at the Eurozone level. Actually, the EU economic recovery plan spends more time talking about structural reforms than it actually talks about recovery and fiscal stimuli. Third thing, misunderstanding the Greeks. As a Greek, you can always complain about, you know, nobody really understands us. I think there's, maybe for a good reason, I think there's a clear, very fine issue here that the exploding and the very strong evidence of past cheating, not only in the recent past, but you know, going quite far back, was confused for a lack of credible commitment in the current conjecture. I take it that it's very open to interpretation how much you trust the current government on its commitment to reduce the deficit and implement some reforms. But I think the past evidence, you know, we have a structural break, which is the crisis. So if you want the Lucas critique, all the parameters change, don't trust the projections. They tell you nothing about today because everything has changed since. Although some of the statements by the government that reforms don't have to be painful, the salaried people won't have to pay for the cost of the crisis, they don't help with believing that there's a credible commitment there. Anyway, another point, assuming that the source of the problem is the fiscal position rather than the market speculation, and this goes to what I said earlier about the spreads, but the problem has to do with the long-term structural imbalance of the Greek economy rather than with the impact of the crisis on financial speculation. I can show you, a table of the fiscal position of selected countries in the Eurozone and the OECD. Of course, Greece has a very high deficit. It always did. But it is comparable to some countries, Ireland, Britain, even the US, it's not far off. Greece has a very high public debt, and it's increasing, and with the current recession, it's going to increase even faster, but it's nowhere near Japan's, it's very similar to Italy's. In a way, it's not very different from Germany's. Okay? If you can say that 73 is reasonably close to 115. But it's not very far away, okay? In a way, Germany has almost twice as much debt as the US has, and Greece has not twice as much debt as Germany has. Okay. Third, believing that fiscal consolidation can be achieved without economic recovery. Okay? That if we remove the state, we will crowd in private investment. Well, these things may happen in Britain, may happen in the US. I have my reservations how much they happen in Greece. I think if you remove the state, there's a vacuum. I'm not sure private entrepreneurship is going to fill it in Greece for a number of reasons, partly because of tax evasion, partly because we don't have the structural characteristics for increasing our competitiveness, coming in from the education system perhaps, entrepreneurship, the role of family in the society, and so forth. And finally, and related to the above point, that forgetting that what the literature has told us about crisis and reform, what we know or what we thought we knew from the literature was that once the crisis is over and we are in T+2, the first or second term of recovery, then you implement reforms. But somehow, we ended up with a situation where now, which is the peak of the recession for Greece, we are requested to implement the toughest of reforms. So additional measures requested over and above what is promised in the stability program, and actually only a few days after the Commission said the stability program looks fine, and then they changed their mind. Okay, so the proposed solution, I'm copying this from a recent paper by the Chatham House, the proposed solution is painful reforms, openly and boldly put. Whether Greece adopts austerity measures or has the market to impose those measures, there's little option but to cut the deficit in the current account, and the so the competitiveness issue and the budget deficit, implying a steep recession and dropping imports. Achieving both growth and fiscal consolidation seems highly unlikely. I think all economists agree with that. But the rest of it, growth will have to go be to give away, is definitely a position statement. You know, what about fiscal consolidation being smoother than happening in a very short period of time? The other common interpretation is that close monitoring of progress by the European Commission or by the European Union can increase the credibility of Greece. Another reading of that could be that actually solidarity by the European Union would increase credibility of Greece. But then these are open to interpretation. So my point here is that by all these misunderstandings, we have two missed opportunities, one of each of my two players. For the EU, a missed opportunity to develop a common voice and a common policy against the markets. So if markets speculate against the euro or against the eurozone member, the EU has missed the opportunity of dealing with that. It has missed the opportunity of creating an institution to complement the ECB, as academics have spent lots of time talking about the coordination problems in the eurozone. Some of my students here can testify to that. And one of the good things about crises is that they give the opportunity to reform. Well, an area where we need to reform is how we complement the supranational monetary policy with something similar at the fiscal policy level, perhaps a European Monetary Fund, or thinking again about fiscal governance at the supranational level, as was the original plan about the Monetary Union. Moving on to Greece, what were the missed opportunities of Greece? I think, and I'm going to say in a moment, a missed opportunity to address the chronic problems of tax evasion and efficiency. This was a plan also mentioned in the convergence program, in the stability program, but because of the additional austerity measures that have to be taken, I think a government cannot do it all, especially with public opposition also in the streets, so they will forget about tax evasion and just increase taxes and blame it all to the EU. In that sense, the situation in Greece was not a success story of stimulating policy activism at the European Union level. A missed opportunity as well. And I think more importantly, the initial plans for smart growth and smooth adjustment, even before the elections, by the current government, have all been washed away. Now we're talking about extreme austerity measures, immediate results, forget about reconstruction, restructuring, and so forth. This can come once the public finances are in good order. Do I have another 5 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, so what was the crisis about, what was the response, and then what happened after the deterioration of the situation in the last couple of weeks? We think Greece has a fiscal crisis because it has very high debt and an exploding deficit. But Greece had always had a very high debt, and not always, but for many, many years, and very high deficit. And it survived. It actually achieved very high growth rates, quite high employment growth. With high deficit and high debt. So you can survive with high debt. Many countries have. Is it a liquidity crisis? Well, we think it is. Can Greece refinance its debt? Well, in the first 2 months in 2010, Greece refinanced 25% of its debt. It has another 10 months to refinance the rest of 75%. So the money is there. The markets invest in Greek bonds, maybe because spreads for Greek bonds are inflated, so it's a good return. If I had any money, I would invest actually in Greek bonds. Is this an economic crisis? Well, it's not really an economic crisis yet. Unemployment has been rising, but actually growth rates have not been terrible. Actually, for the last four or five years, Greece has been consistently in the top 10 performers of the OECD in terms of growth rates. Okay, so not bad for a country with all this kind of structural imbalance and so forth. However, with the projections of the austerity, the impact of the austerity measures taking effect this year, the projection for 2011 is here. Greece becomes the least growing economy in the OECD. Okay? In a period of 3 years, it moves from position top 9 to top 30, i.e. bottom. Okay? So Greece has not been performing bad, so not really an economic crisis. What is left, a credibility crisis. The statistic story hasn't really helped. So in this backdrop, what has Greece responded, what has proposed in January in the stability program? A cut in public sector bonuses, in the bonuses received by public sector workers, which is redistributive. The low paid do not pay any, do not experience any cuts. The top paid experience a cut of 20%. New income tax scales, which are again redistributive. New property taxation, which is again redistributive because it aims, it targets large property. Elimination of tax exemptions, which is again sort of redistributive. And then some non-redistributive taxation on cigarettes, you know, targeting again the smokers, alcohol consumption, fuels, and so forth. And then, of course, reduction in tax evasion. So really, there's a combination of redistributive measures and measures to, for fiscal consolidation. Okay, this is the full list of the measures. We can sort of look at specific detailed items if we have time in the discussion. So what happens after the Commission and the markets decide that, well, Greece is not going nowhere, additional measures are needed, painful reforms are needed? So Greece is either promising or obliged to implement an increase in VAT of 2 percentage points, or even more if deemed necessary or in some specific product categories, additional tax on fuels and other consumer goods, further expenditure cuts, including expenditure in education, which we sort of believe that it's a very important thing for increasing the competitiveness of the country in the long run, but also in public investment, abolition of the 14th salary, either in the brutal way of just saying you don't have a 14th salary, or by introducing a flat 7% wage cut, which is more or less similar to abolition of the 14th salary, and of course, again, pension reform. Okay, so the common pattern here is reduced demand. All these measures reduce incomes, so they will definitely reduce demand and strengthen counter distribution, okay, because they affect direct taxation rather than income taxation. Is there a problem with this? Well, I think there is a problem in many, many respects. One has to do with legitimization. The public opposition in Greece about the additional measures have to do partly with the perceived shift of ownership of the reforms. A few months ago, Greeks thought that, well, you know, we've done the situation very bad, we have to do something about it. Now it's Brussels, it's Frankfurt, it's whoever it is that are forcing us to do that, and we have all the sort of patriotic feeling to fight about that. Okay, so there's a legitimization issue which doesn't help with the effectiveness of whatever measures are followed. There's, by implication, public discontent due to the pervasiveness of the of the additional measures, so real incomes are really affected, so people have a real reason to get out to the streets. It's not just vested interests, although it is also vested interest. Economic recovery is going to be hurt. Why? Because if you cut incomes, if you cut demand, it has to give somewhere, it has to show somewhere, so consumption is going to go down. By increasing taxation, we strengthen inflation. One of the things we have, one of the problems that Greece has is losing competitiveness because of higher inflation vis-a-vis Germany. If we increase taxes, surely we're not going to reduce inflation. So again, the long-term effect of losing competitiveness. And as I said before, the overall effect of that is that with all this upheaval, nobody can really push for structural reforms in the main areas where it is needed. So what we're going to do is focus on tax evasion, taxes, just increase the revenues, try to deal with the short-run dimension of the situation. The permanent features of Greece's pathology will remain. So at my final slide on my unconventional policy recommendation, so Greece should actually resist any pressures for additional measures at all costs. They should emphasize at all points that, that there's a limit to how much Greece can adjust and how fast they can. Insist on the European dimension of the issue. It's not Greece free riding on everybody else, but part of the problem in the Greek situation has to do with developments in the euro. Join calls for redefining macroeconomic policy objectives, but in a credible way, not in a panic way. There's quite a lot. Stiglitz is talking about first recovery, then additional measures. Oliver Blanchard from the IMF has been talking about redefining macroeconomic policy. So there's a number of credible calls in the academia that call for that. Aim at curbing tax evasion, but in a careful way, not to harm the incomes at the bottom. Aim at addressing inflation, because this is the main issue that affects competitiveness. And try to strengthen the growth drivers by utilizing whatever resources can be used by the European Union, the European Investment Bank, the Convergence Programme, the former Cohesion Support Framework, by tourism or whatever else. Try to bring in, to maintain demand in a situation of sluggish growth. But above all, I think Greece has only very limited ability to pursue any of these targets. So the thing you can do is brace itself and learn to live with recession, pay for the long-term past mistakes. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. We've had two excellent presentations in terms of the economic position of Greece. I want to add one or two additional aspects to this, and then we should be left with ample time to have discussion with the audience. I want to pick up on one or two points. I'm going to be as brief as I can. I wanted to add to the discussion that there are lessons here for Europe itself, for the Eurozone. The discussion about Greece exiting the Eurozone or whatever, I think has to be placed into a perspective, a political perspective, as opposed to an economic one. It is inconceivable that any Greek government would voluntarily suggest Greece would exit the euro system. The cost of doing so would be tremendous. And if we remember the way in which the Eurozone has been established with the Maastricht Treaty, there is no provision, legal or political provision, for a member state somehow to be expelled. It's not there. Therefore, I think we have to adjust to a situation where Europe and the Eurozone in particular has to learn the new politics of solidarity and to interpret what solidarity might mean in this context. So there can be no exit which is within the bounds of sensible economic policy. I noticed at the beginning of the week, the noted, or perhaps the previously respected European economist, Ottmar Issing from Germany, was suggesting in the Financial Times that perhaps Greece could take a holiday from the Eurozone.
Feldstein.
That it could take a holiday from the Eurozone, because Armageddon just for 2 months kind of thing. It seems to be inconceivable that this is on the agenda. But it is, of course, a big test of the Eurozone rules. We have to remember the way in which the Eurozone was established. Quite consciously, they decided not to have a system of economic governance, no bailouts, etc. By contrast, the dominant philosophy has been the German one, ordoliberalism. Economies put their own house in order. That is, you cannot import fiscal discipline. Fiscal discipline is created from domestic conditions. That's what was bought in the Maastricht Treaty. And we've seen, of course, the backlash amongst publics, the European media, tremendous criticism of the Greek case in recent times, prompted by this sense that the Eurozone rests on fiscal stability being established domestically. Clearly a fear that what the Eurozone might do for Greece could set a precedent for the so-called PIGS or other groups of countries. I agree with one of the points that Vasilis mentioned, that the way in which the Eurozone was established, I think, reveals currently, as it were, a design fault. To have a Eurozone with an ECB and monetary union, but relying on some kind of gentleman's rules in terms of fiscal stability would seem to be a recipe for a crisis. A new debate seems to be necessary in terms of establishing perhaps a European monetary fund, a European monetary fund which may have a wider remit. Clearly at the moment there is the option of recourse to the International Monetary Fund, but for political reasons, It's not on the agenda, the Eurozone isn't suggesting it, and Greece isn't seeking it. I think an additional lesson from the Greek crisis has been the way in which the Commission and Eurostat have managed the data and received the data. Almunia, of course, is in the firing line in recent times, but clearly the Commission should have been asking more questions about dodgy dossiers, as it were. We saw the references to Goldman Sachs and the credit default swaps. We had to put it in perspective. I think that, according to the report that I saw, it suggested that the swaps which had been obtained were the equivalent of about 1% of Greek GDP, an adjustment otherwise, in other terms, at the margin. It would not have substantively changed the situation. But there's a lesson in terms of how the Eurozone regulates such behaviour. Greece is not the only country to have had such swaps. So I think from the crisis, there are lessons for Eurozone management. But also, a very big lesson in terms of Greece owning the crisis. We learn from psychiatry and psychology that when there's a crisis, the initial response is to deny it, the second response is to reject it, and a third response may be to somehow adapt oneself to it. Well, I think in this situation, there is perhaps a danger of not accepting the full ownership of the crisis. 3 points. When times were good, the roof wasn't fixed. That is, for more than a decade, Greece has had a situation of favourable high growth, favourable interest rates, the opportunity of reducing the debt. The opportunity was not taken. The European Union predicts next year a debt of 135%. I don't accept the point that Greece has always had a high deficit. We've lived with it in the past, therefore let's live with it in the future. The fiscal rules were established on the basis of seeking some kind of proximate activity, proximate fiscal management, proximate debt levels. Forgive me, I think the suggestion that 75% is close to 130% or whatever it is of the order of Rome is close to London. There's also the lesson, of course, that the data has been repeatedly questioned. I take Costas's point about the need for an independent fiscal authority. We cannot deny, I think, the fact that the crisis has been predominantly domestically driven. Can Greece get out of the crisis? I'm struck by the reports in recent times, which highlight the strengths in the Greek economy. There has been, in relative terms, no severe banking problem. Both the European Union and the IMF predict that economic growth in Greece after 2011 would be amongst the highest in the Eurozone. Beyond the short term, I agree with Costas that there are issues of structural reform which have been around for 30 years. The issue of pension reform, I say with experts in the audience, pension reform in Greece, if I remember correctly, the first committee established to look at pension reform was in 1988. Each successive government has proclaimed the need for pension reform. Each successive government has had to accept modest reform outcomes. So there is the need for long-denied structural reform. We may, of course, be seeing a shift in public opinion. References have been made to the public mood beyond the what's going on with strikes and street protests. Opinion polls suggest that the climate may be shifting.
there is the opportunity, therefore, for this as a resource to government strategy. But we also have to recognise that in terms of managing the crisis, in terms of a social dialogue, in terms of a social pact, there is no history of successful social pacts in Greece. References made to pension reform or other structural reforms. If we look at the union voices, union protests, it simply strikes me as an outsider that the domestically within Greece, the loudest, strongest union voices are precisely in those sectors which must bear some of the costs of the upcoming austerity measures. How could you possibly have meaningful pension reform which does not revise the pension benefits of public sector workers, or indeed their job security? I've always wanted to say this. Is the politics stupid? Beyond the economics, beyond the questions of the excuse me, the economy, we know the economic constraints which have been outlined. It's a question, therefore, of establishing an appropriate political strategy. It strikes me that what Europe has been trying to do thus far, and would be well advised to continue, is some balance between toughness and solidarity. An approach which may empower domestic reform. External empowerment works in those contexts in which there is a cultural support for Europe. Greece is par excellence such a context of strong public support for the European Union. Threat of marginalization, exclusion from Europe would resonate very strongly in the Greek context. A combination of toughness and solidarity. It strikes me, though, that thus far the government in Athens has been making the kind of signals, noises, which most would regard as sensible. The difficulty of the question is of how far it could maintain the political will, given the strikes today, strikes expected again shortly. It suggests to me that a government strategy should try to emphasise the evidence of a shift of public opinion as opposed to what's happening in particular sectors with the strikes which are underway. There clearly is a question of whether the government can maintain its political will. Let me finish with the theme of governments itself and the extent to which government itself is fit for purpose. If we're looking at reform, it is the politics stupid. Firstly, it's a question of the extent to which consensus could be built, as Kostas has mentioned, the extent to which there can be social dialogue and a social pact. Nothing suggests that we should be optimistic on that account. But the second political answer is to look at government capability itself, the operation of government. If we look at the budget system, we had a seminar not long ago at the Observatory, which highlighted the remarkably antiquated system of budget management across Greek government. In 2009, the budget had 14,000 separate budget lines. On what basis can that be managed in terms of assessing the effectiveness of the spend, whether the spend is achieving the targets? How much does Greece spend on education? Answer, it's what the Ministry of Education spends on education. That's not quite the same thing. The ability to look at how expenditure is allocated, the effectiveness of that expenditure, seems to be missing from this remarkably diffuse, antiquated budget management system. Governments have not given themselves the information which they would need to be to make the difficult decisions in terms of allocation of priorities for public expenditure. governments need well-refined information to be able to decide that, given our priorities, we wish to shift expenditure to new items. Successive governments have settled for poor quality data, and I'm struck by this acceptance of government leaders being in power but not giving themselves the resources, the information, either technical data or perhaps policy advice to be able to make better informed decisions. A colleague suggested to me, who previously was at the very centre of the government, the previous government, that perhaps the answer is that governments get the information, the type of quality of information that they're willing to settle for. That is, do governments really want the full high quality information to make informed and difficult choices? Poor quality data may indeed give more political discretion. We need a shift of the climate in terms of such policy planning. And yes, government fit for purpose, a context in which policy evaluation, impact assessments are totally alien to this culture. A government fit for purpose would tackle those particular points. I'm very much struck as an outsider by an institutionalized system of weak internal government coordination. If we simply think at the very center of government, between prime minister, cabinets, and the administrative system, it strikes me that what we have is a governmental system under successive governments with what we might refer to as a vacuum or a hollow center. Constitutionally, we have a tremendously powerful prime minister. In terms of resources, we have a very limited prime ministerial position. If we were to compare the staff, the resources, the advice coming to the prime minister in Athens, the prime minister in Athens has an office about a third of the size of that of Dublin, for example, which is considerably smaller than Greece. Other international comparisons would sustain the point. It is a constitutional, the formal power, our formal powers are imperial. The reality in terms of the ability to coordinate in the centre, the resources are simply not there. We have a government machine with individual ministerial fiefdoms. The best protected islands Greece has are individual ministries and departments of government, poorly coordinated, ministerial fiefdoms, but without an institutionalised cabinet system. This is ministerial fiefdoms, where cabinet as cabinet does not operate, meets infrequently, does not have an institutionalised system of cabinet coordination. The government itself gives itself a low capacity to monitor what is going on across governments, a low capacity to evaluate whether government objectives are being met or not. So it is, I think, the kind of suggests the politics beyond the economics. It's a question not only of the political strategy of winning public opinion, of engineering a social consensus between unions and business. It's also what's going on at the very centre of government, of whether government itself, under successive parties, whether government itself is fit for purpose. Where are we at in terms of future scenarios? I think the idea of default and failure seems to be, to me, very unlikely. I cannot imagine that any rational government in Athens would not take the measures sufficient to avoid a default, sufficient to avoid any question of exiting the euro system. I think as a scenario, it simply belongs as some kind of abstract option. Where we are, I think, are between two options. That is, whether Greece will simply muddle through and avoid the short and medium term crisis with the financial markets, but will not actually have the capacity to pursue substantive, serious structural reform. And we know the language of structural reform because these are the items which have been repeatedly defined by successive governments, the labour market, pension reform, etc., etc. Whether Greece can do the third option of avoiding the crisis and undertaking serious reform, I think, is still to be seen. We are between options 2 and 3. Thank you very much indeed. So I will revert to my chairmanship role. We have plenty of time for questions, contributions. Please, if you could identify yourself, and I'll identify Bernard for himself, because he's actually shy and retiring, and invite him to ask the first question.
I want to try and move this a little bit away from purely the case of Greece, but I want to pick up first of all the question of statistical credibility. When I think about the shenanigans which we have seen in Greece, or we claim to have revealed to us in Greece, I think about similar shenanigans in this country. So that I think about a continual redefinition of the starting point of business cycles which have been employed by the government of this country to justify particular fiscal stances. So I think we have to be kept back in there, who is guilty of this and how many people are guilty of this. I think, however, that what we have to recognise is that for the last decade and possibly longer, not only this country or not only Greece has actually been living in some kind of bubble. Now, we know very well because respectful institutions like the National Institute in this country have suggested that, in fact, most of the growth that we have experienced for the last decade is actually illusory growth. It is probably, and I think we agree, that Greece has experienced something similar, or at least a similar period. If we come back to Martin Feldstein, who we will be learned about with respect to his holiday. Martin Feldstein, you might or might not agree with the practicality of his solution.
Which is a trivial concern.
Which
sure.
is a trivial concern. What is more interesting, it seems to me, is the number which is referred to. Because what he is talking about is the necessity for effectively a 30% devaluation, which also translates, if you put it into something like maybe a 30% wage cut or a 30% cut in consumption. It is this illusory wealth that we have, which is something which is produced by non-credible statistics. And those non-credible statistics exist in quite a number of other EU countries and not just Greece.
Okay, thanks. Can we take a number of comments, contributions?
Yeah, just following on that point about Martin Feldstein and the leave of absence from the euro. I mean, he actually has gained quite a lot of support for this from fairly significant figures like Samuel Breton, and the estimate was between 20 and 30% reduction, and it would actually avoid a sort of decade of very severe austerity and increased unemployment in Greece, and it certainly seems to be an idea worth considering. The second point that I wanted to make was just this. This is just a crisis, I think, that was in the making. I mean, the European monetary system was, the former government of the Bank of England said it was 10 years premature. People like Sam Breton, although others said, well, actually got that wrong. It was probably 20 to 30 years premature. And you have this wonderful word convergence. And where is it? Where has been the convergence? And if it's the politics, stupid, it's not just the Greek politics, it's the EU politics. And it basically, that means the German politics. And the German press at the moment is hysterical about bailout. I mean, Otmar Issing was mentioned, and of course he's completely anti-bailout. And when Karl Otto Pohl, the former chairman of the Bundesbank, was here, just probably at the height of the crisis, about a year and a half ago, I mean, he was actually talking, when he was asked about bailing out or helping Eastern Europe, those actually who have at the borders adjoin Germany, he actually just just said one word, nine. That was all he said. So, I mean, you know, if he's going to say nine to Eastern Europe, what's he going to say to, what are the Germans going to say to Greece? I mean, you've got to get real about this. I think it's, you know, the Germans are really, I mean, there's a huge pressure on the government from the German people.
Okay, perhaps if we take one more at this stage, we'll have plenty of time for rounds. The woman at the back. Yeah.
Just want to address the general policy mix that Professor McGeary suggested here, which I personally find indefensible, although parts of it I think you'll find very few people in this room disagreeing with, in the sense that it ignores two, well, I think there's a lot wrong with it, but specifically, it ignores two very important issues. One, you seem to be ignoring the European Union aspect altogether. Mm-hmm. Turning to the IMF, EU membership is not addressed at all in this policy mix. And the other thing is, we've heard these exact measures prescribed to other countries with similar problems before, many times before. And it's like saying, oh, you have a headache, take an aspirin. Do we not need to take into account the conditions on the ground, path dependency, culture, for example, in the case of labor unions? And in that respect, is it possible to defend a one-size-fits-all exit from this crisis, as I think you are?
Okay. We'll come back for another round in a moment. Costa, do you want to start off?
Yeah, I'm not completely sure which part of my suggestions are indefensible. Fighting tax evasion, I guess. Yeah, well, I guess fighting tax evasion might be culturally sensitive. allowing people to.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, you've already made your point that you've said in a blanket way indefensible. The guy is responding to your less than specific question.
Pension retirement at 55, I think that's not indefensible. Making the labour market actually operate and getting young people to find jobs in less than 2 years to 3 years of time, that's not indefensible. You might think the IMF, perhaps that's what got you going and the whole thing rolled out. Well, at some point we have to actually consider the mechanics of how Greece might solve a liquidity crisis that might actually happen. Now, the fact of the matter is that there is no mechanism within the EU to fill that gap. That doesn't exist. It is illegal, right? That's a fact. And that's what we signed up to. And that's what all the Eurozone countries signed up to. Now, either the EU, in that eventuality of possible default, will invent a new mechanism, we're not sure how, and they will pretend, they will act like the IMF, in other words, and say, this is a tranche of money, you can have it in, say, three or four blocks, depending on the reforms, or they will have bilateral loans from countries like Germany, which is extremely unpopular in Germany, so that might not. So, you know, the IMF ultimately is a clean and clear solution. We might not like it, but that's what it is if we do not manage to increase the credibility of the deficit. Now, there's something that Vasil said. The problem with the deficit is not the level. It's the fact that the markets at the moment believe it's unsustainable, and the interest rate is much, much higher than any conceivable growth rate we could have in the next 5 or 6 years. So that makes it completely unsustainable. So we have to, and the more they think it's unsustainable, the more the risk premium is going to come up, and that's taken us to default, and that's quite clear. Now, on the Feldstein, I mean, obviously, that's why I talked about increasing VAT, because increasing VAT doesn't only increase the tax base and improve the revenue position, it is a bit like a devaluation, because effectively, and you're taxing imports at the same time, right? Because you're importing goods, you're increasing their costs. Right, you're actually implicitly making it more profitable for local companies to export if they are in the tradable business. 30% devaluation does not mean 30% reduction in incomes, because we do have a non-tradable sector. But of course, it is quite. I mean, we do import a lot. The problem with Feldstein, so taking Feldstein and saying that we need devaluation conceptually, that, you know, that's of course a very nice insight, that's what he's saying. Taking it as a practical proposition, the problem is that if this happens, then the whole euro program is no longer credible, because the whole idea of the euro is that you can't devalue, that it's an absolute
so you could.
As any way of taking holiday and then revaluing the, you know, revaluating the contribution of its country to the euro, the effective exchange rate is a realistic solution. I think it also has very big implications about the, you know, future attacks on the euro, how credible the euro is, but also how. Yeah, okay, but you know, we can choose whether we make the situation worse or whether we try to not make it worse. But also has implications about what the countries feel, how domestic politics then deal with, okay, is it in the interest of the unions for the country to get out of the euro for 10 months to increase wages or to do whatever and then get back in? And then, you know, you unleash a very big set of issues at all levels, the supranational, the governmental, and the domestic level. So I don't think it's a good idea. It might seem much more a better idea on paper, as things do happen. The other point that you made about the, you know, this has been a crisis of making, EMU has and was always going to lead to divergence, low inflation in Germany, high inflation in Greece, and so forth. So we always have permanent structural divergence. What are we going to do about it? But then, you know, we didn't only sign up to the project of fixing the exchange rate. We didn't only sign up to the project of having, you know, a common monetary policy and some sort of coordination of fiscal policy. We all signed up to trying to actually achieve convergence, and actually trying to achieve convergence means implementing the policies in order to do that. We do have some policies, the convergence program in the structural funds, but maybe we need more policies. And the EU has always thrived on its policy innovation. When it stopped innovating, it always got into sort of problems. So the fact that we have a treaty that forbids us from using bailouts doesn't mean that we cannot try at least to have another treaty which actually tells us how we deal with competitiveness issues, how we deal with asymmetries within the union. And that's why I was talking about missed opportunities. Otherwise, you can take a very pessimistic view and just say, well, Greece doesn't belong to the same currency area as Germany. But we knew that, so no news there. Just on the other point about the credibility of statistical data and the room for manipulation by governments, I'm in part of my life an applied economist, and I do take data as given in my empirical analysis because I don't think there's any point in trying to question data. It's always wrong. It's always, you know, the political outcome. It's not just objective measurement. So yes, obviously governments manipulate data, the government of this country included. Well, they don't lose the data. but to what extent this led universally or, you know, sort of equally across the board, across the region, to an illusionary growth of false perceptions about growth, I'm not quite sure. I think it has happened to different extents. When the housing bubble in Spain, the UK, in Ireland, has created false ideas about how much money I have in my pocket or in my bank. But in Greece, actually, growth has been quite successful. We tend to complain a lot about sort of jobless growth and so forth, but we forget that there's something like a million people that came in the country and found jobs in a period of pretty much 10 years. And beyond that, we have an increase in employment participation rate. So there was, you know, job creation, and in that sense, also real incomes created. Of course, you know, some other issues were not addressed, and you know, this explains the situation. But I don't think that, you know, the issue of statistical of manipulation of statistical data in the case of Greece relates to this kind of false idea, false perception about actual growth.
Can I take a moment to answer to the...
No.
We'll have to move on because there's other people.
Underline a few points. I'm the last person in this world to
decided to go ahead for the common currency. So it was a political decision. It is a European problem, has to be solved within the Eurozone, and I'm afraid I would like to say that we don't want the figures to be happy. We want the people to be happy.
Okay, good, thank you.
Don't you think we're exaggerating a bit about moral hazards and ECB issuing bonds for the countries? I mean, there's been so many advances in economic theory about moral hazard. I mean, why do we always mention the problem and we don't mention the possible solutions of having a common bond? It seems to me personally, and through reading all the articles in the press lately, that the European countries are leaving Greece vulnerable to the spread, to be punished, because for two reasons, because they were giving flawed data for their credibility, because they haven't followed their advice the last few years, but also because they have the highest per capita net inflow funds from all the European countries. And for those two reasons, they're just letting Greece be punished through the spread and not doing something about it.
Okay.
Why can't we have ECB issuing common bonds?
Okay, thanks. Jump right here.
My question, I mean, I fully agree with the conclusion about the fact that we're going to move ahead. I mean, we're going to find a solution, IMF or European bailout or something. So I come to the last two points, either muddle through or do structural reforms, which obviously are needed, have been needed for years, and everybody knows it. But indeed, it seems to be that we're going to point to muddle through. But how can you... Can you tell us what you think could be the agenda for someone going into strong structural reform? I know it's a bit of political fiction, but how can we at least imagine going there?
Okay, good, thanks. Stella?
A couple of questions, because I'm a modern economist and I'm trying to understand some things that seem to me as paradoxes. You both mentioned the deficit matters because the markets believe it is unsustainable, you said. And you said about the credibility. I don't see, this is something that sounds to me completely non-economic. It sounds very structural, and I don't understand who is the agency behind it. Who makes it not being credible anymore, the real economy, and what makes it suddenly that the markets believe that it's not that sustainable? Is it the media? How do you understand it? This is a question I have all these last weeks. Why did this happen now? And then the first set of measures that were set and they were accepted, how quickly can we know that they don't work? Why the Commission so quickly and the media say we need new? To me, again, this seems a bit of a paradox. It's very quickly for some of the structural changes to have happened anyway. You know? And one to the chair, you're talking about the Prime Minister's office being weak, and this means that they cannot control the changes. Do you think it is only a matter of the Prime Minister deciding to strengthen this office, or would it mean a lot of bargaining because it's a balance of power behind it? You know, the fact that the ministries actually have power is because they represent specific parts of the population and the regions. So how can this happen?
Okay.
Thanks. Good questions.
Costa, do you want to start again?
Sure. I'd like to start with the last question. It's of course extremely insightful and an interesting question. I think two things are happening. One thing is real. So suddenly you come to the bond market and you say that you've been borrowing from us thinking that we have a well-ordered kind of budget, but actually now we're telling you that all the statistics are false or misleading. So suddenly you introduce a lot of uncertainty in the system. So, of course, at that moment, the bonds are repriced because of this uncertainty on the real fundamentals. Once they are repriced, of course, that creates a cycle because suddenly the whole deficit has now increased and the whole debt potential liability has increased because you've got to service the same debt at a much higher interest rate. And that creates a cycle of credibility and high interest rates. But I think there is a trigger, and the trigger is the revaluation of the debt because of the underlying uncertainty. On top of that comes the realization that these long-term issues that I tried to discuss actually matter. In other words, the country is not in such a good position that we all thought. So they also reassessed the long-term growth rate. Now, if they reassess the long-term growth rate and that falls below the some kind of equilibrium interest rate, suddenly the maths say that the thing is exploding. So that, of course, puts a higher risk premium on it. So we've got a trigger which increases the amount of risk, reduces the growth rate, and then the math just implies it's unsustainable, potentially. So that's I think, how it works. Although, you know, it is a different and very, very interesting question, but which needs more work on it. Now, what's the agenda? What's the agenda for reform? That is, you know, that I think is. I think we need leadership. I think governments postpone all the time. So, you know, they feel that they cannot grapple with it. So a new government with a new mandate has to sit with stakeholders and get them to agree that, let's say, reform in pensions or reform in union legislation is important. And you have to build consensus. And you have to build consensus when you have the political clout to do it. Now, or in the Karamanlis case, in 2004. You can't say in 2004, well, we will do mild adjustment, because once you're doing your mild unadjustment,